IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Greetings to all our listeners. Welcome to another episode of All Things Policy, your favorite daily public policy podcast from the Takshashila Institution. I'm Anushka Saxena, your host for this episode, and a research analyst with the Indo-Pacific Studies Program at the Takshashila Institution. And today, I have the distinct privilege of interviewing Mr. Manoj Joshi for views and insights on the China angle in contemporary Indian foreign policy. Mr. Joshi is a distinguished fellow at the Observer Research Foundation in New Delhi, and I'm sure we're all well aware of his illustrious and highly acclaimed work on neighborhood and terrorism studies, as well as on the India-China border issue. I'm honored to host you, sir, and I warmly welcome you to the episode.
Thank you.
So, Indian foreign policy is continually evolving. It has to navigate a complex regional and international political scenario, from wars far away from home in Ukraine and the Middle East to regional conflicts and economic tensions vis-a-vis our various land and maritime neighbors. The military security perspectives of Indian foreign policy have become dynamic. And at the same time, the growing sentiment of protectionism across the global economy and de-risking vis-a-vis China is also afflicting the Indian economy and forcing us to make hard choices. So, sir, if I may come to you without further ado, my first question would be, what do you believe is the nature of contemporary Indian foreign policy? Because we hear a lot of descriptions attached to it today, such as it is becoming increasingly stern, charged, and some even suggest it's becoming wolf warrior-like, which is ironic. And in your understanding, are some of these assessments true? And if so, why? And why not? Over to you, sir.
Well, I would say that it hasn't changed much, actually. Meaning, it used to be based on non-alignment earlier. Now we call it multi-alignment. I think, by and large, I would say that Indian foreign policy. Basically works on the old maxim that we are trying to preserve and push our national interests. The focus has been, primary focus has been on self-interest. And I don't think that has changed. But there may be a stylistic change with the prevalence of social media and other things, you see, that draws out a certain kind of style. But I wouldn't say that the basics have changed. The basics, I think, to my mind, remain the same, and which is that the policy is based on self-interest.
Right. And sir, would you say, just to quickly follow up on your response, some of our approaches to, say, the Russia-Ukraine war or the Israel-Gaza war have fundamentally reflected a continuity in our larger policy towards Russia or the Middle East? Or are there any stylistic changes in our responses to those as well?
Well, as you know well, that in the old days, India may have supported the Palestinians a bit more strongly. Now it has developed strong ties with Israel as well. So it has sought to balance that. In the case of Russia, I think the sensitivity towards Russian interests is very much there. And I think if you look at even Indian public opinion, I dare say that it is supportive of Russia, not supportive of Ukraine. So that is seen as a Western enterprise, and India's position is seen as a largely neutral position. Neutral, but Russia-leaning position.
And sir, in terms of contemporary Indian foreign policy, the understanding is also that India's own biggest external security challenge is now China, and in both the military security and economic security domains. And so, specifically in the military security domain, what kind of challenges is China posing to India today, in your opinion? And are there any additional factors vis-a-vis power play in the making of the regional order to consider, aside from, of course, the border issue?
Well, the obvious security issue is the border. And the fact that it is disputed in its entirety, and the fact that in 2020 there have been certain incidents there which have been a bit difficult to understand. So border is very much there. As far as the larger, often people speak about the Indian Ocean as being a venue of security competition. But I don't see it that way, because the PLA Navy is still very much focused on the Western Pacific. And their presence in the Indian Ocean is very, very trivial. But there is a political-military challenge, in the sense there's a political challenge in China's relationships, let us say, with Bangladesh, Myanmar, Sri Lanka, Maldives, Nepal, and these countries. It's not that they are fundamentally anti-Indian. But the thing is that what you do see is that China, what we see is that China is playing on our turf. And there is little we can do about it, and except to handle it in a subtle way. But China is playing on our turf, and I think China has long-term plans with regard to the Indian Ocean. But those plans, I don't think, are going to unfold in a hurry.
Right. And sir, I'd like to come to the question about our neighbors in just a bit, but to quickly follow up, there is a lot of threat perception building in the Indian discourse community about the capabilities of the PLA, how the Navy is the largest in terms of vessels, or the Army is the largest in terms of personnel. And this could really mean enhanced capabilities that India perhaps could not match in the coming years on the border. Would you say this threat assessment is justified, or should we take it with a pinch of salt because of the fact that the PLA has virtually no combat experience?
Well, besides the combat experience thing, I think even if you look at the terrain, if you look at the terrain of the Himalayas, for example, you know, neither India has strong positions, and the Indian Army is forward deployed right across the entire border. Besides that, then there's the question of the terrain. Now, yes, the Chinese have the advantage. They're on Tibet. They work on interior lines. We work on exterior lines. But the fact of the Himalayas makes it very difficult for either side to launch any kind of major operations across the Himalayas. Whether the Chinese try and come through the Himalayas, or we go through the Himalayas, because it's a very fragile area, it can be easily disrupted. Logistics would be a major nightmare. And in the case of China, the logistic tail goes 3,000 kilometers to the heartland of China. You know, whereas our logistics are about 200 kilometers away, meaning our main bases are 200 kilometers away. So both sides have their relative advantage. When it comes to air power, the fact that Indian airfields are at near sea level, hiding behind the Himalayas, whereas the Chinese are visible on the Tibetan plateau. They have much fewer well-protected airfields than we have. Of course, they do have a well-developed missile force, which can be very destructive in any campaign. But I don't think they would be able to follow it up with any kind of a land movement across the Himalayas. Whereas, and then you look at the naval part of it. And naval, as I said, they may have the largest navy in terms of ships, but their ability to deploy on this side of the Straits of Malacca is not that easy, meaning it is under surveillance. We are strongly based in the Andaman and Nicobar Islands. We also surveil the Sunda Straits and the other areas with the help of our allies, the United States and Australia. The United States remains the strongest navy in the Indian Ocean. See, and we are close. We have a close partnership with them. And as I said, that as of now, the Chinese, of course, they have their anti-piracy task force, which keeps on coming annual visits to this region. and maybe what 22, 23 task forces have come. But those are kind of more of training missions than anything else, because they're using the excuse of piracy for that. Beyond that, I don't see the PLA having a significant military presence in this region. Meaning, India has the geographic advantage. It juts out 2,000 kilometers into the Indian Ocean, you see. And I think we can interdict Chinese oil supplies from the Gulf anytime we want, you see, in the event of hostilities. So there are advantages that we have in the maritime area, which the Chinese cannot easily offset.
Makes sense, sir. And just to delve a little deeper on the border issue in specific, we are now 4 years and 21 core commander level talks into the Galwan standoff, since the Galwan standoff. And in these years, what insights have you gathered as to why China perhaps behaved the way it did? And what factors can we rule out? For example, some scholars claim that China acted aggressively because of the repeal of Kashmir's special status under Article 370. And so what are some of the reasons that we can debate behind this aggression? And what were the signs that we perhaps missed out and are now focusing our attention on?
Well, to be very frank, it is a bit of a mystery. It's very difficult to say just why China acted the way it did, because things were going fine. We'd had the Wuhan summit, we'd had the Chennai summit, and then suddenly we were confronted with this. I don't go with the 370 thing because, you know, that doesn't affect China, because China is already occupying the Ladakh that it has claimed. It's on its claim line, you know. So how does the status of Kashmir affect it? My own thing is that it is, my own belief is that it's a combination of factors. And the combination of factors includes things like India's relationship with the United States. You know, the Chinese have earlier, they have seen their primary threat as coming from the Taiwan direction. You know, their primary threat, but their focus has been on the Taiwan direction. And the US, Japan, and those forces that they face there. Now what they are seeing is with the India-US relationship, because in 2020, India also signed, well, that was after this win. But the thing is that what they are seeing is that the southern front, which is the India front, which earlier they had to merely stabilize, now they are seeing that southern front is becoming closer to their adversaries in their eastern front. So I think this could have been an effort to fire as a warning shot. And note that what were the events of 2020? It was not an invasion. It was not an incursion. What the Chinese did was to establish blockades in 6 places. And when I say blockade, what do I mean? In those 6 places, there were certain small areas which we both patrolled by common consent, because we have overlapping claims there. So what they did was to effectively put their forces there and say, we won't let you patrol beyond this. So now, of course, as you know, in 4 or 5 of those places, we have worked out no patrol zones, see. But the largest area, problem area, which is the Dipsang Bulge, remains. That is about 900 square kilometers, where the Chinese are blockading us and we are unable to patrol those areas. And you know that paper that was put up by PD Nitya last year, she had said that we are unable to patrol 26 of the 56 patrol points. So I think earlier we were remiss. So the whole point was that the border was patrolled by our people, but those patrols went, you know, 4 times, 5 times a year. Perhaps we could have established posts instead of just patrolling points. But one can't say that because, you know, unless you see the terrain there and the climate and the conditions, because it's simply not possible to occupy every inch of the line of actual control, given its size, given its location. There has to be some common agreement between us and China. And what the China did was to effectively negate the confidence building measures that we had built up so painfully.
Thank you so much for that, sir. That makes a lot of sense. And just to come back to the point you made about our policy vis-a-vis our smaller neighbors, the China factor has perhaps played out the most significantly on that front. And in the past decade, countries such as, and this is just an observation, but countries such as Bangladesh and Sri Lanka have often played India against China with impunity, while countries like Maldives have had relatively stable ties with India. But in the last 2 years, there is a shift in stances where Bangladesh and Sri Lanka are both signaling a relatively stable relationship with India. With Bangladesh, say, for example, India has refrained from making a comment on the nature of the elections. With Sri Lanka, there are some promises that they're not going to let any Chinese vessels dock at its ports. But Maldives has become quite the opposite and is becoming increasingly pro-China, especially with the Muizhu government. Is this trend so because the countries are realizing the threats China may pose, or are these just continued attempts at hedging and playing one against the other?
I think they're basically continuing trends, because if you're a small country and you have two large neighbors trying to take advantage for yourself, it's perfectly par for the course. There's nothing extraordinary about it. The only thing is that obviously a country like India, obviously if I'm the country, you know, they, because these are my neighbors, and what happens there can have a bearing on my security, which is not true for China. In the sense, if something happens in Sri Lanka, it doesn't affect China's security as such, but it affects my security immediately. If something happens in Nepal, well, Bangladesh, it doesn't affect Chinese security, you know, or Maldives. So the thing is that we are definitely more sensitive to it. But I think the best example we have ourselves shown, whether it is Nepal, whether it is Sri Lanka, whether it is Maldives, that if you don't get overexcited and you let the trends play on their own, things often resolve themselves. Meaning, in the sense, in Maldives, when you had the Yameen government, that was also seen as being anti-Indian. And then came the election of Nasheed, you know. And even now with Soli out there, we know that there is a strong segment of Maldivian opinion which is pro-India, you know. In Sri Lanka, again, in the Rajapaksa period, there were lots of trends and developments that were viewed as anti-Indian, see. But when Sri Lanka had its financial crisis last year, they found that the only country that was willing to step up was India. See, the thing with India's neighbors, the interesting thing is they are geographically locked to India. If you're Nepal, if you're Bhutan, you open out into India. If you're Bangladesh, you're almost completely surrounded by India. If you're Sri Lanka, you're far away from everywhere but India. And the same thing is true of Maldives. So all these are India-locked countries. So we have huge geopolitical advantages there. And I think if we use our minds and we don't get overexcited, don't get into too much of the wolf warrior mode, things will sort out in our favor.
Stay tuned to All Things Policy. We'll be right back after a short commercial break.
Right. So, sir, in that sense, would you say that Myanmar has kind of escaped the India-logged aspect and in that, you know, it's chosen to favor its other bigger neighbor a bit more, and India virtually hasn't been able to get what it wants vis-a-vis, say, extremism in the Northeast?
Well, the thing is that if you look at where Myanmar is on the map, you know that it's not India locked. You know that it is geographically in a different position. But the thing is, as far as extremism in the Northeast is concerned, you know, how much can the government in NAPITOR control? They're already having, they are the ones who are now having difficulty. They are unable to control, to maintain control over their own country. And they have also, we have played the game, and in a sense, we were involved in Kaladan multimodal project, constructing the Sitwe port. The Chinese have come on hard out there. But you see, the point is that it's also the, for a long time, we supported Aung San Suu Kyi, and the Myanmarese government decided they would much rather go with, rely on the Chinese, who make it a point to say that we don't interfere in the internal affairs of others. But China has also changed now. China is very much, has been involved in trying to mediate between NAPITOR and some of the ethnic groups, you know, the Three Brotherhood Alliance and others. And as far as Myanmar, given where it's located, there would be a very obvious tendency for them to play off one against the other. They border the ASEAN, they are borders of China, they border India. So they have options, they have geopolitical options, and they do exercise them. But, you know, by nature, the regime is such out there that it is not being able to control the country.
Right. Absolutely, sir. And I think the China angle also plays out very interestingly in that I believe China has potentially provided some weapons to the Three Brotherhood Alliance. But the goal for that was to crack down on telecom fraud and smuggling from across the border with China. And now those same weapons have become a challenge for the government. And so, yeah, Myanmar is an entity of its own with many complex problems and a China angle. But just to come to another neighbor of concern, of course, which is Pakistan, even though no real big terrorism-related issues have been flagged, at least in the past couple months or years, the influx of drones and drugs again is a continued issue. And what can we assess about India's response to this in particular, especially when internally too we're observing this becoming a challenge in states such as Punjab? And is there a potential imprint of, say, Chinese funding or encouragement behind these gray zone tactics?
I don't think the Chinese are involved in that. They may be Chinese drones may be used, but that's because Chinese are the world's largest drone manufacturers. This is the Pakistani thing. And I, for one, think that we need to step up our deterrence. I mean, say after, when we said that you attack us in Pulwama, we will attack you in Balakot. Now, there is a certain logic to deterrence. That is that unless and until you punish the other side, you are not able to maintain deterrence. So now those drones are coming very obviously from Pakistan. I think that the government can do more besides just shooting them down, meaning there is a point in which they can warn Pakistan, you know, that these guys, we will not tolerate this beyond a point, and we will act so, and we may reserve the right to attack the bases from where these are being launched. So I think that either you follow up on your own laid out policy in 2019, or you deal with Pakistan in the way you have been dealing with so far, which is in a largely defensive framework. That means we basically repel whatever they, whenever they try to hit us, we basically play it on a defensive in the back foot. See, so except when the terrorist act becomes, when it's a huge act like the Pulwama thing, then we are compelled to this thing. But otherwise, we just let it happen. But I think beyond that, I think there is, one cannot be passive. I personally think that there is a need for a diplomatic outreach. Or well, if you don't want to put it a diplomatic outreach, but the need to resume some kind of back-channel discussions with Pakistan on the need to stabilize the region. It's to our mutual benefit, you see. And Pakistan always claims that we are also suffering from terrorism and things like that. Some kind of engagement can be worked out or should be worked out to promote peace between these two large South Asian countries.
Right. And on that, sir, both India and Pakistan are part of the RATS terrorism, anti-terrorism mechanism of this organization we know as the SCO, Shanghai Cooperation Organization. We don't hear a lot about it, but it does have a terrorism mechanism for the region as a whole, of which both India and Pakistan are a part. So do you think that provides for an accurate platform for the two countries to try and discuss, or this is something that only back-channel talks can help with?
What was the platform you said?
The Shanghai Cooperation Organization.
Oh.
The SCO.
Yeah, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization certainly, you know, if we are doing diplomatic outreach, back channel, then of course we should employ all the channels and also get the Chinese. But, you know, the Chinese have been so bland about this whole terrorism thing so far. They've been so unhelpful in this. But as I said, we are members of SCO, so certainly we should utilize the platform to the extent we can. But I think the breakthrough will require a back-channel process, direct bilateral process.
Moving out a bit beyond the neighborhood, India's partnership with other major powers also has a China lens attached to it. So. You alluded to this earlier, and many accredit India's relatively recent proximity with the U.S. and alignment on key strategic aspects like lunar governance through the Artemis Accords or defense co-production through IndusX or even critical technology interoperability through initiatives like ISET, and that they've become possible because of the mutual challenge China poses to the two countries. But at the same time, there is also an acknowledgement that India's Russia policy is about the bilateral ties and the friendship alone, and it does not care for China's no-limits partnership with Russia. And so is this your assessment as well?
Well, yeah, I think by and large, I would say that that is the assessment, in the sense that the China factor has been the primary factor which has driven the United States and India closer to each other. And the China factor has not been able to drive Russia and India apart. Okay, meaning, but there is a subtle change till about the mid 2010s. If there were new weapon systems, Russia would give us the top of the line and China would come next. But after the S-400, the first country to get the S-400 were Chinese. So there is an element of economic calculation also there, in the sense that if we are trying to replace Russia as our principal arms supplier by diversifying our imports or getting it from the US and this thing, then the Russians cannot but want to promote their exports. And they, if the Chinese are willing to take it, they would Chinese can pay top dollar for it. See? So I think this is a classic case of the current era of geopolitics, where countries are very firmly putting their self-interest, you know, before everything else. You see, and it's not a matter of ideology.
So just on the India-US partnership, like you also mentioned earlier, that the Taiwan challenge is one of the primary ones for China. And in that sense, on that front, US becomes China's biggest adversary. So now that India and US are talking about defense interoperability or alignment against a mutual challenge, is there a role for India to play in perhaps the Taiwan issue? If not with, say, boots on the ground or supporting any U.S. defense endeavors diplomatically, should we butt ourselves into this?
You know, I think we need to be a bit careful on the Taiwan thing, because, you know, we are always already vulnerable on Kashmir. So Kashmir, most people don't realize, is not recognized by most countries as being a part of India. It's recognized as a disputed territory, whose status needs to be finalized. But in the case of Taiwan, most people recognize Taiwan is part of China, and there is one China, this thing. So there is a Chinese invasion of Taiwan, and occupation of Taiwan will not be seen in the same category, in the sense that, yes, it would be a terrible thing, it would be very destructive, it would be very wasteful, but people would still say that the Chinese are occupying a renegade province. Now, my worry is that if you start, you know, supporting Taiwan beyond the point you're doing now, I think we have a certain relationship, which I think is quite good, mutually beneficial. The Chinese could step up support to Kashmiri separatism, you know, and you could have the government in exile, you know, in Kashmir. And don't forget that we already have the Tibetans here. See, and the Chinese have not made that much of a noise, all said and done, you know, even with the Tibetans and the Dalai Lama. So I'm saying this is a fraught issue, and you have to be a bit careful because of the nature of the thing. But yet, I would say that we need to strengthen our ties with Taiwan on all other fronts, meaning whether it's the economic front, technology front, the other front. On the political front, we need to be a bit careful.
Well, that makes a lot of sense, sir. And I would have one final question for you before we conclude this episode. So going forward, what in your opinion would be some of the key structural issues in the India-China partnership that we should try and study more and look out for, especially as both countries compete for leadership in the Indo-Pacific or in the Global South?
You know, I would say that the key thing is that all said and done, we are neighbors. We may be hostile neighbors, but there are areas of cooperation and there are areas of conflict and there are areas of competition, you know. So we need to identify these clearly, draw red lines wherever we can in these particular areas. And I think we can still structure a mutually beneficial relationship and stay out of the possibility of war, which would be completely devastating, you know, in the sense that for both countries, whether it is Taiwan, whether it is here, any war, meaning we've seen what is happening in Ukraine or what is happening in Gaza, that, and especially India and China, which are heavily armed, their nuclear weapons powers, prospect of war is not a thing. So, as I said, we need to draw the red lines. We need to compete. We need to cooperate. You see, so we have to structurally work out this relationship. As I said, make the red lines clearer and say you can do this but not this. You can do this but not that. And primarily for us, a lot of it has to do with Pakistan because China's tendency to look away from the issues of Pakistan's support for terrorism. So yes, China is committed to Pakistan. China is committed to Pakistani security. But we have to diplomatically perhaps urge China to at least in one particular area not to do so, which is the area of terrorism, which, you know, which would be perfectly fine. So the problem with China is that it has become all-encompassing, the whole thing. And so they have been, I would say, taking a very, very questionable stand with regard to Pakistan on this very difficult issue of terrorism. Meaning in the past, they have done all sorts of things. But I'm thinking at this point, we should focus on the China-Pakistan relationship and also make our red lines clearer there, you know, on the China-Pakistan relationship.
Right. Thank you so much for that assessment, sir. With this, we come to the end of the episode. I would like to express my sincere gratitude to you, sir, for your time and your wonderful insights today on a very fascinating subject. And as we conclude, I would also like to encourage our listeners to pick up Mr. Joshi's 2022 book, Understanding the India-China Border. I have really enjoyed reading it and I hope others will as well. So thank you once again to you, sir. And thank you to our listeners for tuning into another episode of All Things Policy.
Thank you.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. you can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week: Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank, and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.